This is Iran Radio, and we have some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. Considered to be a verbal revelation by Allah, this is the actual word of Allah. The Quran is the holiest book for Muslims. Literally meaning the recitation, the Quran is widely regarded as the finest work in classical Arabic literature. Although the entire holy book plays a significant role in the daily rituals of its followers, the first surah, known as Chapter Al-Fatiha, is the most recited of the Holy Quran. This chapter, which consists of 7 verses, is repeated in daily prayers of Muslims and on other occasions too. Now we listen to the translation of this holy chapter. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Praised be Allah, Lord of the two worlds, this world and the hereafter, the beneficent, the merciful, and master of the day of judgment. You alone we do worship, and from you alone we do seek assistance. Guide us to the right path, the path of those to whom you have granted blessings, those who are neither subject to your anger nor have gone astray. And now the continuation of the programs. You are listening to Iran Radio. Coming up in this hour, we begin with the spotlight. Afterwards, we return with another segment of radio production. Up next, Spotlight. Stay with us. There is much to explore.
The Spotlight.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. The United States has deployed 3 guided missile destroyers, several warships, and a nuclear-powered submarine to waters near Venezuela to counter what it claims to be maritime narcotics trafficking. 2 weeks ago, Donald Trump rebranded the Department of Defense to the Department of War and then immediately moved nearly 4,000 U.S. sailors and Marines to Venezuelan waters where, in grave breach of international law, they attacked a small boat, resulting in the extrajudicial execution of 11 people on board a vessel. And that was just the first boat targeted. At the same time, U.S. authorities bumped up the prize on the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro's head from $25 to $50 million U.S. dollars. And along with the massive flotilla deployment has prompted Caracas to mobilize and prepare for possible U.S. invasion. America's military deployment to Caribbean waters and looming potential of destabilizing outcome is the focus now of our Spotlight program. But first, here's our guests. Joining us is Don DeBar, radio host and journalist out of CPR News from New York. And Mr. Clyde Menzies, researcher and commentator, joining us from London. Gentlemen, hello. I'd like to welcome you both to the broadcast here. I guess, Don, we'll start with you. Good to check back in with you, and good to see you're safe and doing well. Don, your thoughts on this U.S. campaign to fight drugs near Venezuela, getting down there and immediately killing 11 Venezuelans on this small boat, no due process involved, no drugs or proof has been shared with any of us, the international community, and now another boat under the same circumstances, another 3 people killed, 14 in total, yet there's been no victim, there's been no proof laid for any of us to see. Your initial thoughts.
Well, let's see. So the U.S. military is going to solve the drug problem in the United States by killing Venezuelans in the Caribbean. They went to Afghanistan, as I recall, and brought back a huge heroin problem to the United States and Europe. They went to Vietnam, as a matter of fact, and had the same result. There is the experience of the Iran-Contra affair, where the U.S. government actually brokered the sale of cocaine through Colombia and other points in South Central South America. I don't think exactly these characters are the ones that are going to solve a drug problem. And if they are, certainly the way to do it is to shoot boats. And I would suspect finding the place where these drugs are growing and dealing with the government that is allowing it there by negotiation one way or another would be a place to at least start. You would want to bring international pressure if you're going to do something crazy like these people want to do. And I would assume that you would start by providing some evidence that there's drug cultivation or trade or something going on before you start shooting the place up. And finally, I'm thinking about as they blow up, the U.S. blows up boats directly in the Caribbean, the flotilla going to Gaza and the history of those people being, for example, nine people being executed on the deck of a boat in May of 2010, including an American. Maybe this is cover for what's about to happen with the next boatload of supplies for Gaza. I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me. It makes as much sense as making Juan Guaido president of Venezuela made when John Bolton was on board last time.
All right. Thank you there, Don. And Mr. Clive Menzies, pleasure to have you. Thank you for your patience, sir. Your initial take on this massive U.S. naval flotilla now down there in the Caribbean in Venezuelan waters, over 4,000 sailors and Marines involved. Okay, where they are, the pretext the U.S. is using on fighting drugs there, what these this flotilla coalition has so far done, killing these 14 Venezuelans, the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, has called it outright murder.
Well, undoubtedly it is extrajudicial killing. I think the wider question, there's a long history of fermenting regime change in Latin America. Over the last decade, we've seen the transition of, if you like, more socialist and sympathetic governments to their people, change in Argentina, Ecuador, Bolivia. Venezuela has been a consistent holdout, and that's why it's in the crosshairs. But actually, I think the timing is probably, as your other guests suggested, is much more to do with the destructive potential of this this outrage, for want of a better way of putting it. I mean, Trump is such an inconsistent individual, and as I've often said on your programs, these politicians, they are not in control, they're puppets. Certainly Trump is something of a loose cannon, but he was claiming recently that he's done more to create peace in the Middle East than anybody else, which, you know, is just a nonsensical statement. And the man is inconsistent, contradicts himself, constantly claims one thing when doing the opposite. And I think this piece of, if you like, geopolitical theater, its primary role is to distract the attention, the rising awareness and outrage of what's going on in Gaza, with the full complicity of the US government and other governments in the West, and creating mayhem across that region, not to mention many other transgressions that are going on around the world. But I have said that for some time that these acts of madness or the craziness that is rising in the world is indicative of a dying structure. The structure that we've lived under for centuries is now at its apogee, and it's falling apart. And so there is a desperation to get ahead of the curve. So claiming drug running from Venezuela is just another attempt to try and, if you like, get ahead of the curve and distract people from what's really going on.
Great, Clive, and I'm glad you mentioned. Let's talk about getting ahead of that curve and distracting people. Don, all the places the U.S. could be fighting drugs right now, this is what makes this campaign extremely suspect, along the same narrative that Clive was just taking us through. Because Trump never mentioned drugs when it came to Venezuela till recently, not in his campaign. He did mention fentanyl every other day in Mexico, and that we might put boots on the ground into Mexican territory, fight Mexican drug cartels. And then that got a lot of blowback from the Mexican president, you very well remember. But he never mentioned the drug trade in Latin America going after Venezuela for drugs until very recently. And now let's get at some of the stats involved. In 2023, over 100,000 Americans overdosed from fentanyl, less than 30,000 from cocaine. Last year, the numbers were slightly down at 75,000 fentanyl, 25,000 from cocaine. Every other word out of his mouth was fentanyl and Mexico throughout his campaign. So why is he in the Caribbean in front of Caracas?
Well, first, the reason that he's doing this with Venezuela is obvious. It's oil. The same reason that they see nuclear weapons behind every tree in Iran, it's oil. The same reason that Russia is evil and bad is oil. The same, you go down the list, Nigeria, wherever, any place that there's oil that belongs to the people that own the United States. You people are all of you, the whole planet full of you, are sitting on top of their prized oil. If you don't get out of the way, they're going to drop bombs on you, and they'll have to make up stories to do that to satisfy the people. They're going to be driving around in cars with that oil here in the United States. But the purpose of this, obviously, is because they lost control of Venezuela's oil supply back with the election and the first administration of Hugo Chavez in 1998-99. In any event, even interrupting normal commerce, first with sanctions and now interrupting the sea lanes, I assume, coming in and out of Venezuela, there's some market control being exerted against Venezuela with respect to oil also. If you really want to solve the drug problem in the United States, because there's a huge market for drugs here. Why? Because people are scared to death. People are completely uncertain about their housing, their health care, income. The unemployment is massive. The official numbers are a joke, but also if you undo the changes that were made in the 80s and 90s and use the old numbers, even they're a joke. People, young people, people under the age of 40 even at this point, have no idea how their lives are going to turn out because they are not ready for the world that's being constructed and delivered to them. And they're scared. And this is the kind of environment where people anesthetize themselves with drugs. And if they wanted to solve that problem for a tenth of the money they're spending on weapons and troops and every other damn thing, what they could do is give people jobs and some education to retool them for the world that is coming and pay for their health care and just make sure people feel secure enough that they don't feel the need to anesthetize themselves. It's entirely possible.
And the funny thing, Don, you remember in his first term, he wanted to cut all these social programs to build his wall and pull around $3 or $4 billion out of social programs, to your point. Anyway, I'm going to put that same question, if I can, to you, Mr. Clive Menzies. I read this article earlier, so-called drug cartels Trump has reported to be in pursuit of, and I read this verbatim that said, although most of the cartels on the terrorism list are Mexican, Washington has focused its attacks on Venezuela. So, sir, let's visit this question again. Why? Why is the U.S. with such a huge fleet there off the Venezuelan coast?
Well, at the risk of repeating myself, it's largely a matter of distraction. And I think Don is correct in saying that, Iran has oil, Venezuela has oil, and that is part of the plan. But I think it's actually much wider than that. And in terms of the social situation in America, I don't think there is any intent from the government, which is controlled by higher forces, to actually make the American people feel better about themselves. There's been a war on us all, irrespective of where you live in the world. I mean, America is allegedly one of the richest countries in the world, and it's got something like 60 million people on food stamps. And, as Don says, there are many other social problems. I think if there was a serious intent to address the drugs problem, then people would emulate Portugal, which has turned drugs from a criminal problem into a social problem. So they don't criminalize drugs, but they actually provide social support, healthcare, making sure that people are, they have access to support when they have a problem with drugs. So there is no motivation or there is no intent to alleviate the pressure on populations around the world. So drugs are just one manifestation of the war on us all. And you go back to why. This war on us all began, well, it began centuries ago, but in the current millennium, it started on 11th of September 2001 with the so-called war on terror. There's long been a so-called war on drugs. We've had the climate change narrative, which has created the green agenda, which is further limiting our potential as human beings. There's been an attack on, in America particularly, there's been a consistent attack on food. Small farmers are disappearing as agribusiness and the likes of Bill Gates acquire huge swathes of agricultural land. So this is all part of the same process. Everything is connected. There is war on us all, the COVID psyop and the vaccination deaths, not just from the COVID vaccinations, but as is coming out in the news and in mainstream news, which has been buried for so long, the amount of the vaccine program for infants and young children is directly connected to high levels of autism, death, and many other problems. So this is just part of the whole war on us all. And to believe that any government is actually acting in their people's interests, in the West particularly, the US, Western Europe, the UK, and spreading increasingly across the world, is nonsensical. The likes of Gaddafi were definitely actually working for the benefit of their people, as are many others of those that have been targeted or removed. They've been demonized in the Western media, demonized by the political puppets across the Western hemisphere, and they are removed. So what people need to ask themselves is, what is government worth? What is it doing for them? Absolutely nothing. They are clearly criminal as it becomes more visible daily, not least through extrajudicial killing. And this nonsensical drumming up the war against Venezuela.
Mr. DeBar, thank you there. Clive, Mr. DeBar, Trump has accused Colombia next door failing to tackle the drug trade. The Colombian President Gustavo Petro said, the audacity you guys have for 50 years, you've had the so-called war on drugs, you failed to become even a fraction of success at it, and she should be one to point fingers at us. He says actually his tenure, President Petro, he's been more successful, curbing the cocaine trade in his country than any other recent president. But my point that I want to make is that these Latin American leaders, many in the region, they know there's a problem when it comes to drugs. But what they see bigger right now is this threat posed by the U.S. on their doorsteps, like leaders in every region. Why is this seems to them a more of an existential threat than possibly the drug trade or the terrorism trade in other parts of the world or the weapons trade? Is to have, or the warlords running amok, or something like Daesh terrorists in the region, they don't want U.S. support or help because they know it comes at a heavy price.
Yeah. For many years, Colombia and Peru were the source of this massive cocaine habit that the United States had. It follows the military and the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency, as they call it, wherever they go. Suddenly there's a massive drug trade. Colombia has had problems with this going back, since the 1930s maybe. And because every time there was a popular government elected or wrangled its way into power against the wishes of the United States, there was a coup or some other kind of an overthrow of the government. And basically military dictatorships or fascist dictatorships of one kind or another, Quislings to the United States, took power. They massacred progressive leftists, all kinds of dissidents on an ongoing basis. And finally, with some semblance of democracy, President Petro's the first person actually successfully dealt with the drug problem in Colombia's history, and they want to start something with him. It tells you that the entire scenario is a lot of nonsense. and that what they're angling to do is get their geopolitical aims realized. Certainly with Venezuela, we know what that is to get rid of Venezuela as an example, is to destroy to the extent that they can the multilateralism and self-determination that kind of has prevailed for a while for the first time in 200 years in Latin America, and the multilateral agencies like CELAC and others that have too much clout as far as American business is concerned can be destroyed if you catch the nexus, which is Venezuela.
Right. And Mr. Menzies, I want to put this question to you. Where do you see this tensions going now? Nicolas Maduro has already mobilized his military. He's reached out to the people that be prepared for all-out possible invasion or a war. Now, here's a president that's coveted. You very well know very non-discreetly that he wants the Nobel Peace Prize. He's an anti-war president. But here we are, a possible precipice of some kind of conflict. How far do you see things going? Do you see an attempt by the U.S. at invasion or possible regime change in Venezuela?
Well, I think it's very difficult to predict. I mean, my sense is that there are a lot of, for want of a better way of putting it, kites being flown. This war on us all has taken many, many forms. And this sort of threatening of a third world war has been sort of looming and increased. But my sense is that unlike, we're almost living through a repeat of the early 20th century with the lead up to the First World War, in that there is a sort of heightening of jingoism, as it was called then, and division, nationalism, all of these things. And these are being preyed upon by the likes of Trump and others as excuses to make America great again and all of these things. But I get the sense that unless they have the support, the overwhelming support of the people, as say in Britain they did running up to the First World War, where people were almost made mad in wanting war. It was something to be desired. I think because of the internet and communications and an increasingly diverse source of information, there is far greater reluctance for ordinary people to go to war. And it's always been the case that it's governments and those in power that want to go to war. It's not the people. They have to be persuaded. And I suspect because the narratives, all the different narratives are falling apart, my sense is that this won't come to fruition. It may start, but it won't be successful. Not least because America as a military power has been waning for some time. It talks a big talk, but it has problems walking the talk. They failed in Vietnam, they failed in Afghanistan, they're failing in NATO is failing in Ukraine, which is a proxy war. So all these attempts at war against any nation, I think, are failing. The Russian military operation progresses it's progressing almost unaltered in spite of all the threats and machinations. My sense is that Venezuela won't be much different, but clearly I'm not in the business of making predictions.
And we don't have much time left. I want to put that same question to you, Mr. Don DeBar. How do you see at the height of the tensions with this thing going? But really quick, before you answer that, I also want you to, if you could, with a little time we have left, speak on U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio's role in all this. And I'll tell you why, because just recently it seemed that Trump was supporting engagement with Caracas. He sent a special envoy, Richard Grenell, to meet with Maduro in late January, and they continue seeking cooperation with the Maduro regime when it comes to deportation flights. There have been 9 up until just this last month, so there seems like there's some contradictions here. But here's Maduro this Monday branding the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, not Donald Trump, as the Lord of Death and War, and said that most of the dialogue between the two arch foes has completely broken down and leveled most of the blame for that against Rubio. And the irony here is that Rubio was in West Asia this week, you very well know, making heartless and insensitive remarks about Palestinians and the future of Gaza. So this characterization of the U.S. Secretary of State as the Lord of Death and War, how do you see it?
I think he enjoys that being called that. I think Trump had Marco Rubio pegged in the primaries in 2016 when he was calling him Little Marco.
Mm.
Marco Rubio himself is nothing. Okay, he's a glamour. He's got some like a charmer of a politician from Florida, out of the Miami community. You know, out of the Cuban exile community, basically. He is an extreme right wing politician, and he is he's basically the John Bolton of this administration.
Mm.
The question I have is whether or not, and this is the thing that we've been asking, I mean, it's the wrong question, okay? What matters in terms of American politics here are people's movements or lack thereof. Otherwise, the space is filled by every kind of crooked individual you could find, government, business, whatever. When you had first Bolton come on board, it seemed contradictory to me that Trump was talking about no more wars, and Bolton was the most belligerent fool that you could ever meet. And I thought that meant there was going to be a belligerent policy. Well, instead, what ended up happening was Bolton was given enough rope to hang himself, and he did. And after it was over, Trump it essentially characterized him as being a lunatic, bloodthirsty. Now, they also stole a few $1 billion from Venezuela at that time during the ranting and raving. And so that may well have been the point altogether. But I'm hoping that Rubio's function is to serve the same purpose that Bolton's did, which is to satisfy a particular element of the elite that Trump is look out for their interests in Latin America by putting a hard-nosed person up there, almost a mad dog, and however, keeping him on a short leash. And I'm hoping that's what we're looking at, but who knows?
All right, gentlemen, time has gotten the better of us. Appreciate having you both on. Mr. Clive Menzies, they're joining us from London, and Mr. Don DeBar joining us from New York. And this brings us to the conclusion of this episode of your Spotlight program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Syria without Assad, freedom or new chains. Jackal uncovers secret deals, Israel's corridor strategy, and militias vying for control. Nation broken, a new West Asia in the making.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Everyone, welcome to this very special edition of Face to Face. As Lebanon is still reeling from the latest Israeli war crime, the explosion of the pagers that struck civilians and fighters alike. And most of this act occurred in areas which were ordinary places, like markets, like the streets, and even among families and friends. And within this issue, we are going to be joined by the survivors of what has become as perhaps the most blatant and the most gruesome terror act committed by the Israeli regime. And this comes also in violation of international law. Now, their voices, although they carry in some instances the pain of sudden loss, at the same time, we also see the strength of resilience, and it will be very significant for the entire world to hear their voices. Today I am joined by Rida Arruz, who is a writer and a poet, but he is also a husband and father. I'm also joined by Zainab Mustrah. She is a newlywed, and of course, they are joining me here today to give their testimony to the entire world about what is happening to them today, a year on this terror act. Let me begin, first of all, with Rida Arruz. I would like to know, really, and I want the world to know, what went on in your mind just as this pager exploded? What did you think it was? Did you think it was a specific assassination against you? Were you surprised to see that there were many others like you, and most of the ambulances and the people were rushing to take those wounded into the hospitals?
Just before the explosion, I was at work, but I could have been at home. Many who were subject to this explosion were at home with their families. It could have been close to my daughter, and she would sometimes hand it over to me when it beeped. I was at my office and really focused on work. Usually, I don't give attention to the pager when it beeps, but it beeped this time longer than usual, and that led me to check what the issue is. When I held it to my face, there was a message which read, "Pager error, press OK." But when I first held it, I realized that it was extremely heated, and I had the feeling that I should throw it out of my hand. But I was in a closed and isolated room. It was a matter of seconds and the pager exploded. And at that moment, I felt that something had happened to my hand and my left eye. The eyesight in my right eye was gone completely. My colleague was with me and he was down. I woke him up and he said it was a drone strike. I told him no, it wasn't a drone strike. They detonated the pagers. You might ask me how you were certain that it was Israel that detonated the pagers. To tell you honestly, I always felt uneasy having this device, but I never thought, and no one would think, that such a satanic plot is possible and that anyone could plant explosives in this device. When it exploded, I knew there was something that we could not fathom. This was not a malfunction. Maybe some thought the lithium batteries blew up and that this was a result of a malfunction. But I knew it was a deliberate act of detonating explosives, and I knew there were explosives in the pages. I knew it was Israel, and I knew we wouldn't even find an ambulance car available. I was not surprised. Of course, I couldn't see anything then, and it took 15 minutes till they brought a car and took me, and on the way, we can hear the sounds of sirens from ambulance cars and the mayhem that the issue caused. We arrived at the first hospital, then the second and the third. Still, there were no places. One hospital said, maybe we can receive you, maybe not. I was barefoot and I walked for around 150 meters in the sun on a route that was filled with glass. It took several days to remove the glass from my feet. Even when I went to Iran, the doctors were still removing glass from my feet. I had to go on foot for a certain distance, hoping to get to a hospital where help can be provided. And since there was no ambulances, my friend took me in a minivan, and we didn't find the hospital till we reached Saida. I wasn't surprised to know that a big number of people were targeted, because the scenario that was playing in my mind led me to know that there would be many like me. But what struck me was that I started hearing the voices of people I know at the same hospital. One of the paramedics who later was killed in the war was my relative. He came into the hospital and saw me there and tried to comfort me with a few words. When I reached the hospital, I felt that now I can give in and fainted after having stayed for around 2.5 hours alert and bleeding, and there was unbearable pain. But I had another concern that the man taking me in his car found out that his brother too was wounded and he was nervous. This made me also tell myself and him that if we see that a hospital is overcrowded, then we won't enter. I wanted to make way for those who required urgent medical attention. I felt that I wanted all the victims to be treated before me. I can handle my wounds, I told myself. Maybe others can't, although my injury was serious. Surprisingly, many of the wounded I knew had the same exact feeling. They told the nurses, we can bear it. Treat the others that need urgent help.
أو حالته عسيرة أكثر من قبله. هذه اللحظات الأولى.
That proves your humanity even in such circumstances. Zainab, I want to ask you, as a woman, you're a civilian. You're not an armed fighter. You're not a military personnel. How did that occur? Did you expect that a pager or beeper, which is used in hospitals by doctors and nurses, to explode in your house? And did it explode in your house? This is also another question.
My name is Zainab Mustra. I'm 27 years old. I studied interior design and hold a diploma in public relations and marketing. It was a day like any other, an ordinary day in the life of any young woman. I was working on my laptop when I got up to fetch something. As I was returning, I heard the pager ringing in this strange way. A feeling came over me that something was wrong. I hesitated between going closer to check or staying away, but before I could decide, it exploded. I wasn't even holding it. There was some distance between me and the device. Unlike Sayyid Rida, I never imagined such a horrific massacre could be carried out. Even when I was wounded, I thought maybe it was a technical malfunction. At the hospital, I still didn't know what had really happened. When I stepped out of the car, hearing people's voices, I told myself maybe the pager exploded by accident. And what was happening outside was maybe an explosion similar to the car explosion of 2014. Never once did I think pagers had been booby-trapped, and we know that many carry it around casually. This shows how the Israeli enemy has no morality. Though it claims to be an ethical adversary, in reality it has no ethics, no moral army. Even in war, there are rules, but Israel has crossed every line. They didn't even think about the children and the infants and women who would be victims of this massacre.
Rida, let me come back to you. You said that you expected that there would be many like you, maybe, I don't know, in the hundreds or thousands. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, right after this terror act, he said that the Israelis were planning on assassinating at least 5,000 Hezbollah fighters, and along with them, the other civilians who are surrounding them, maybe in their houses or maybe in the common areas. Did you think that this was an act, a divine act from God Almighty, that perhaps there was a reason why they exploded maybe earlier than the Israelis had expected, that the casualties, we're talking about maybe 12 or so, not more, who were killed as a result of this act? Of course, we have a huge number of wounded, but still the casualties, based on what we learned from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, that it was not as the Israelis really wanted. But they are boasting that this is a huge achievement for them, whether at the intelligence level and even at the military level.
على مستوى إن كان هذا إنجاز أم ليس إنجاز نحن بنجي بنقول هذا إنجاز على المستوى النظري.
As to whether this is an achievement or not, on a theoretical level, if you want to call it an achievement, it's a cheap one. This is not military work. I am part of the resistance, and during Operation Al-Aqsa Flood and the support phase, my biggest concern was not to be targeted because of negligence or carelessness on my part. If I was struck by a drone while active in the field, that would be different. It's part of war. But this, to plant explosives in a civilian device, that's not warfare, that's treachery. That is pure malice and cowardice, avoiding direct confrontation because of an inability to fight us on the battlefield. This is a cowardly act. We told the enemy, come, use all your military tools and face us. I would know how to face it. For them to resort to this, it's backstabbing. This is more than cowardice and satanic, since they have no ability to face us directly. I am certain the enemy resorted to this because it cannot face us on the battlefield. This is certain. For 66 days, this was proven. So they resorted to cowardly methods. What I'm trying to say is, no matter what the result, this was not an achievement. Even if they had prepared 30,000 pages to explode, the outcome was still limited. We learned that 50,000 pages had reached Lebanon, and they were preparing to detonate 30,000. Every intelligence operation has a deadline. It could not be delayed longer. The pages reached us before Al-Aqsa flood. I had received mine 2 weeks earlier. At a certain point, we already suspected something was wrong. The batteries would heat up and so on. The Israelis knew the resistance was growing suspicious. In the end, Israel was forced to detonate before reaching its target. Only 5,000 pages had been distributed. They had planned to hit tens of thousands, but only a few thousand devices were triggered, producing many wounded but very few martyrs. The purpose wasn't primarily to kill but to disable, to take these servicemen out of service. Why? Because they couldn't pack larger quantities of explosives without being detected. They can only put a few grams of explosives, not because they are merciful, but so they would not be detected. In military terms, there is something called a killing ambush. If I prepare such an ambush, the enemy could be caught in it and should not survive. But here Israel set its trap, which was a rare opportunity and a theoretical plot that can only happen once, and they spent so much on it and prepared for it. The result, however, as if out of 30, only 4 were actually hit. And even those 4 weren't eliminated. This was Israel's one-time opportunity to execute its diabolical scheme. But in actuality, they failed miserably. No matter how much they boast or how many golden pages they gift the great Satan, it was not the great achievement they claim, and they will never have another chance. Out of 4,000 wounded, how many were truly taken out of service? Only a few hundred at most. Many of those injured are still active, still present. Among the roughly 400 who sustained eye injuries, dozens, perhaps a few hundred, lost their sight. Yet even blindness did not take them out of service. They are still active, still strong, still fighting. We are followers of Ali ibn Abi Talib. We are followers of Maitam al-Thammar, who was crucified on a palm trunk, his limbs severed, his tongue cut out. Yet even then he remained a soldier confronting tyrants. If he had been alive and nailed to that tree, he would still be leading in jihad despite his wounds. That is our example. المثقل بالجراح المعلق على النخلة
قائدا في جهاد التبيين كما كان قائدا في كل جبهات الجهاد.
I want to talk to you about how active you are now despite the fact that you have lost your eyesight, but let me ask Zainab, how has your life changed? I mean, as a woman, as someone who was engaged, getting ready for marriage, getting ready for a new life, how has this act and these wounds, how have they changed your life and the life of your family?
No one can deny that life has changed. Someone who once went and came freely, who others relied on, now must rely on others. Of course, my life has changed. But this experience has made us stronger and taught us many things. We cannot be weak. The enemy's goal was not to kill. If that had been the goal, they would have put more explosives. Their aim was to paralyze these 4,000 people so they would be a burden on their resistance. But as I have seen from my own experience and from sitting with other wounded, this attack only increased our strength and determination to go on. Even recently, some of the injured sat for official exams and ranked among the top in Lebanon. Israel may have been closed one door of jihad for us, but we are searching for other doors through our wounds to continue. Surely this injury is not an obstacle. I was engaged, and after the attack, this did not stop me and my partner from staying together and having a family. We will continue, we will build families, and those families will also fight Israel. This only creates more hatred and enmity between us and Israel, especially for the women who were injured. It is usually the men who are wounded in battle, But women will have even greater determination than the men because of the oppression against them.
Let me come back to you, Rida. You have you're very active now, even in your current state. You have your own program on one of the local radio stations, political satire, and you're saying that you can do so much. There's so much that you can do. And some people would say that someone in your status would need not only medical care, but also psychological care. But it seems from your friends and family who I spoke to, they told me that you are the one who is giving them this type of support. So where do you get this strength?
On the psychological level, I want to say something. Perhaps one could see it as coming from God. I had just turned 40, and I felt I had lived much of my life in sacrifice for the sake of God. I had spent years on the front lines. I used to pray, asking God to draw me closer to Him. I felt that in the routine of my daily work, my heart was not being purified enough. What I needed was not a small shake, but a strong one. So I asked God for this strong shake, but I did not know through which door it would come. When the pager rang, the enemy wanted to be a door to my physical and spiritual death. I do not believe they could truly kill us with a pager or with a landmine. These devices are mechanically limited. They can only carry so much material. Their aim was to kill our bodies and also our spirits. But I saw that ringing sound instead as a bell calling me to a new door of God's mercy and kindness. The first thing I did when others went to fetch a car was to throw myself on the ground. I didn't collapse. I deliberately lay down and said, "My Lord, praise be to you. What I had been asking for, it seems you answered. I didn't know which door you would choose, but if this is it, I submit to you." I told him, "This life you gave me, I offer it back to you as a sacrifice in your path. If you still want me to remain, leave me here to be active, present, and pleasing you. But allow me to do something. But if my time is over, then let me go to you while bleeding in peace." Yet, at that moment, I felt strongly that God wanted me to stay, and He had given me the blessing of sight. And though the enemy tried to take it away, He would restore it. Indeed, within 2 months after surgeries, I regained my vision. More recently, after further operations, I could no longer see. But I am certain in my heart that I will regain my sight, and this is God's promise to me, and I have full trust in Him. On the level of morale, my principle is, the more positive spirit I spread among those around me, the more strength returns to me. I push myself forward. I show others that I am still active and capable, so they will trust my ability to cope. At the same time, I do not pretend to be a superhero. I tell people honestly, I lost some abilities, but I search for ways to compensate. I lost the ability to perform one function, but I gained the ability to perform many others. During this stage, I read about the lives of many great figures who were blind, yet still highly influential. While I was laying in the hospital just a week after, I began reading again. I began planning the new course of my life, how I would rebuild it, on what foundations and with what mission. I took inspiration from others who had been tested by different hardships and still managed to rise again. I adopted one guiding rule. What did I lose? How will I compensate? And how will I build a new path? At every step, there is a new challenge to overcome. We were raised to see every obstacle as a challenge. And when challenged, we are provoked to rise and surpass it. This is what our leaders taught us. This is how we were raised, in the resistance and in life.
Zainab, what is your message to the world, to leaders, to the leaders of Lebanon, for example, who are watching this interview right now?
Like Rida said, God could have chosen me to be a martyr, When the explosion occurred, sometimes I lamented, asking God, why didn't you allow me to be a martyr? But then I was convinced that God kept me alive because I have a message and I have an important role in this life. If I had no role, then God would have taken me. Now I have changed. I was the timid Zainab that almost never spoke out on television. Now I need to tell the world about the oppression I'm living and to show how unethical and cowardice this enemy really is, causing such a massacre, disregarding the targeting of women and children. I want to show the world that facing this immoral enemy, we are strong and we will not be weakened or intimidated, and we will not allow the enemy to achieve its goal.
Thank you. Rida, final question for you. We mentioned that you're also a political analyst. You're not just a writer and a poet. And your show shows how, in a few minutes, you can let people understand the political situation in Lebanon, maybe more than in any other way. How do you see the future now? And do you think that Israel fears Rida Ruz now, the wounded, more than it feared Rida Ruz before?
There is a trending statement that is used these days, which is restricting state control or reinstating the full authority of the government in Lebanon. It's remarkable that the main question on our minds, which is asked by citizens in all of Lebanon, from the north to the south, where is the government? This question, if asked in any other country, would not be normal or logical. But in Lebanon, it's very logical to ask where the government is when the roads are cut, but the policeman is giving tickets. Where is the government when the electricity comes once a year, like a holiday, but an employee comes to give you the electricity bill? The same question is asked in the banks, the hospitals, the schools, and government institutions. In all places where the government should be, you will ask that question, but you will not find it because it's not there. It's only a formal decor of a government which is not even decorated. Now they tell us, hand over your weapons because the government has to restrict authority. I told them, other issues can be solved in politics. You take people's money from the banks, you don't provide good health care, the school system is down, and there are no good roads even. I can't find the government to help, but there's an alternative to these issues. But when you want to take my arms, that's a different matter. In 1982, when we waited for the government, we saw the Israelis reach Beirut, and the government was on top of the Israeli tank. Now, if we ask that question in the south, it will be an existential question. We will be killed and see that the government is stabbing us in the back. We never found it fighting with us in the south. We will give you the weapons on one condition, that you don't find anyone asking, where is the government? I was 16 when I wrote a booklet of poetry. I never loved taking up arms, and it wasn't my hobby to fight. God told us you will have to fight even if you despise it. The verses in the Holy Quran talk about fighting as a reaction. This is our fight. They are professional killers, but we are good defenders. If you ask me, I never wanted to hold a gun, but I was forced to leave my love of writing poetry, plays, and movie scripts, and even having a chance of directing. I had a dream to work in this profession, and my personality is not that of a soldier. But I cannot be a hypocrite and write poetry and plays about the resistance and not be a resistance fighter. I need to be honest with myself. Perhaps God has taken something from me, as if he is telling me to use all my time now to accomplish my goal. I respect the martyrs killed in battle under fire, but I also highly respect those who were killed by Israel because they took up pens and spoke out. I respect Najil Ali and other novelists and writers who the Israelis felt threatened by the words they wrote. Yes, I tell the Israelis that now I will be more dangerous to you. Now I have time for you. Netanyahu will die and I will remain. Try to kill me now. I will do everything in my power to uncover your reality to the world.
Inshallah. Zainab, you wanted to add something?
I wanted to comment on the issue of the government. We did not hear a clear denouncement from the government for what happened to us. No one reached out to help us. It is unfortunate. At the same time, we are grateful to the Islamic Republic of Iran, which took us and gave us the treatment and medical care we needed.
Zainab Musrah, thank you very much for being with us. Rida Riz, thank you so much for sharing your stories, which I think have touched the hearts and minds of people all over the world. I want to thank us for joining us on this very special edition. Goodbye for now.